Welcome, everybody. This is the second lecture of the Mises Academy class, Anatomy of the Fed, this is the second edition of this particular class that we're teaching. So this right now is being recorded on July 2nd, 2012. As always, I just like to timestamp it so that when the dollar collapses and everyone's digging out of the rubble and they find these lectures, they can at least place them. Okay, so tonight we're covering a lot of material. You're either going to be absolutely fascinated by this or you're going to be not understanding some of it. So let me just explain why I'm going over this and trying to give you the encouragement that you can do it. All right. The stuff isn't that hard, but you have to know how to read a balance sheet in order to make this work. And let me just give you a personal confession. A partial one. I'm not going to give you a full confession. We only have an hour and 15 minutes. When I first read Rothbard's stuff on banking, so his mystery of banking and the case against the Fed, he would get into a T account, and that's what we're going to be doing tonight. And so it's basically a balance sheet showing assets on the left side and liabilities and equity on the right side. And he was going through and trying to explain fractional reserve banking and show what happens when the Federal Reserve buys assets and how does that increase the money supply and all that kind of stuff. And I just kind of skimmed the T account part because I was like, okay, yeah, this is the technicalities of it, but I don't really care how they do it per se. I just kind of want to know what's the effect economically. So just give me the economics. I don't care about the banking mechanics. And that was my approach. And I kind of just skimmed through it, and that's fine. And if that's your attitude too, and you're just like, well, this is way too technical. I don't care about this stuff. Just tell me, like, how did the Fed cause the business cycle? I don't care how they cause it. Just tell me that they do, and what are the economic ramifications? That's fine. Like I said, that was what I did the first time through. But if you really want to understand exactly what's going on with banking. And in particular, if you want to understand why Rothbard and many other modern Austrians think that there's something screwy with fractional reserve banking, you really have to walk through me tonight with the balance sheet stuff. And I would like to say, I think if you really try to pay attention in this lecture, and really what you would need to do is get this PowerPoint slide that I'm working through here and have that locally on your own computer, and then maybe after the fact. So it might not all sink in tonight, but then if you listen to it again and you can stop the video and follow the numbers yourself and think, okay, I see what he's doing there, and then start the video up again, that kind of thing. It might take that amount of review, but I really think you're going to get it. This is the best way to do it, put it that way. All right. So part of what I'm trying to say is Rothbard actually, I think it's a little bit confusing the way he does it, and I know why he does it the way he did. What it is, in case you're curious, and maybe I'll point it out as I'm going through it tonight. There's a difference in treating the timing of when the bankers earn the interest and when it turns into equity, and so like to see why is it that bankers, if they're allowed to engage in fractional reserve banking, like what incentive do they have for doing that. So that's the kind of thing we're going to go over tonight. I'm going to teach you and show you how looking at a bank's balance sheet, you can really see, oh, that's why if they're allowed to get away with fractional reserve banking, they would do it, because look at how they basically make money for themselves. But the thing is, it's not just that they print up $100 bills and then go buy Ferraris with it. That's not what they do. What they do is they create money out of thin air, but then they lend it out to people and they earn interest on that money. And then when the loans get paid back, that money gets destroyed. But what's left is the interest they earned on the money that they created and then destroyed with the loan and then the payback. Okay, so it's more subtle than just, oh, the bankers have their own printing press. It's a lot more nuanced than that. And I think it's important in a class like this called the Anatomy of the Fed that you really understand how it is that the bankers make their money. And like I said, it's not, because if they just printed it up and went out and bought stuff with it, they would go bust eventually. That would catch up with them. But what they can do indefinitely is create money out of thin air by making loans that aren't backed up by anything and then charging interest on them. And then as long as the people pay off the loans and they don't have a bank run in the meantime, then they can earn a perpetual flow of income that's theirs free and clear, that it's not going to catch up with them. So that's what I want you to understand. So anyway, back to like I was saying about Rothbard. So he does this kind of stuff in his book, and it's a little bit different. And what I'm doing here is more accurate. And the reason Rothbard does it the way he does it is, for one thing, he didn't want to have 5 different charts. Okay, so in other words, what I'm doing here is more accurate, but it takes more, like I have to show you more states of the balance sheet. And so like the Rothbard kind of like combines a few steps into one thing, and then just in words, he's telling you what happened, but you don't get to see the before, middle, and after, if that makes sense to you. All right, so here I'm going to walk you through it more slowly. And so it's, on the one hand, it's a little bit more complicated, but it's more accurate. And I think you'll really see the point at which, oh, that's where the bankers made their money. Because it's not actually when they make the loan and they create money out of thin air. At that moment, at that instant, the bankers aren't any richer. It's only when they start earning interest, and that involves the passage of time. And so that's what I captured in this PowerPoint tonight that I'm going to walk you through. Okay, and then also I really am going to try to end with at least 10 minutes, hopefully 15 minutes at the end, to give you guys time to field your questions live here. So I think what we've been doing with a class this big is posting those questions in the Q&A section. I think that's what we tried to do, and maybe the TA is going to jump in and say, no, we're not doing that. But so there's already one question in there that I'm going to field at the end of the class tonight, the live lecture. Okay, so let's go ahead and get going. Okay, so the first thing is balance sheet basics. So this is going to be true not just of a bank's balance sheet, but any company. And so I'm just going, so for those of you who are in business, or obviously if you went into accounting, this is going to be child's play to you, but there are some people that might not know this. Okay, so what we're doing here is, this whole thing is called a balance sheet. And then I think it's what Rothbard calls a T account in some of the material you might be reading. And so the left column are the assets and the right column are the liabilities and shareholder equity. The way these things work is it's always going to balance. I think that's probably why they call it a balance sheet. So what you're going to do here is you're going to list the assets and their prices or market values, okay? And then you're going to get a total dollar amount. All right, so that's what this, underneath here, you're just going to add up all the assets that you've listed up here. And then over here, you're going to list the liabilities in their dollar amounts. Sorry, it's hard for me to write this small. And then also the equity, and I'll explain these terms in a second. And then you add up all those, and then you get the total liability and shareholder equity. And the point is, these two numbers are always the same. They always balance. So the assets always equal the liabilities plus the shareholder equity. So what do I mean by a liability? That means it's money that the corporation owes to some outside party. And equity means the ownership of the shareholders. So here we're assuming it's a corporation that has shares. Okay, so one way to think about it is say, okay, so assets always equal liabilities plus shareholder equity. For me, that's actually not intuitive. That doesn't. Why should that be true? The thing that's intuitive is this equation down here that says total assets minus total liabilities equals equity. So, right, if you just look at these ones up here, if you just moved the liabilities over to the left by subtracting it from both sides, then you get assets minus liabilities equals shareholder equity. And that should make sense. So you got a company, it's got assets, right? Things that the company owns. And they're worth a certain amount. At the same time, the company owes money to various people. It has liabilities. And so what we're saying is the assets minus the liability, what's left? Well, that's like kind of saying, what does the company own free and clear that other outside creditors don't have dibs on? And then whatever that is, well, that's what the owners of the company have claim to. So that's what their equity is in. All right, so I'm being, obviously this is real basic stuff, but that's all you need to know before we jump into how banks use this. Another thing is to keep in mind, a balance sheet is a snapshot in time. So it makes sense to say, what's the state of the balance sheet at Tuesday at 3 p.m.? Boom, at that moment, if you went through and value, you know, what's the market value of all the assets? What's the market value of all the liabilities that this company has? Then the difference is the shareholder equity. And it would make sense to say at that moment in time. Whereas if you're familiar with, there's other sorts of reports that accountants could prepare for a company. For example, a profit and loss statement, or what's called an income statement. And that is over a period of time. So to say what was the firm's income, it doesn't make sense to say what was the firm's income as of Tuesday 3 p.m. That doesn't make any sense. You could say, as of Tuesday 3 p.m., what was the firm's income over the previous 12 months? That would make sense. Or you could say, what was the firm's profit or loss over the last 12 months as of a certain time? But see, that there, to calculate profit or loss, you're looking at a flow over a period of time, whereas the balance sheet is a stock concept. It's a snapshot in time. So right at that moment, what's the balance sheet look like? Okay, so let's move on. Well, one last thing. So what I'm trying to get at here is this equity that's on the right-hand side of the balance sheet, that's kind of like a residual category. So it's not that, like, you can independently know what the assets are. You can go out and look them up and say, okay, the firm owns some tractors, the firm owns some farmland, the firm owns some fertilizer. It owns some soybean futures, contracts, and all these things. And then you go out and say, what's the market price for them right now? What's my estimate of the market price? Boom, 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 you value them. Same thing with liabilities. You can say, okay, we have a mortgage on the farm that we took out from the bank, so that's a liability. We've got borrowed money from Uncle Jim when money was tight a couple months ago, so we owe him $6,000. Okay, so that's a liability. And you go through and list them all, the equity is just what's left. It's not, maybe with some people you could have a defined thing, but the equity typically, the equity adjusts based on the movements of the other things. One last thing I should say at this level is if the equity goes negative, that's what it means to be bankrupt or insolvent. Because if you're insolvent, it means your liabilities are higher than your assets. Okay, next slide, loan banking. So remember last class I explained that the way Rothbard explained stuff, there's two types of banking, loan banking and deposit banking. So here we're going to focus on loan banking, and Rothbard likes it. That's why I put the little heart here. All right, so Rothbard is fine with this. So don't be confused, because what's going to happen is you might get a little bit mixed up and think that Rothbard is against banks serving as credit intermediaries. And that's not true. Rothbard is fine with banks taking money from one group of savers and then lending it out to a group of borrowers. And the bank serves as the expert middleman who pools the risks and then uses its personnel to figure out, well, gee, how much, what interest rate should we charge on these different loans, evaluating the credit risk of the loan applicants and so on. Stuff that most people would say, oh, that's what banks do. Rothbard's fine with that. He thinks banks do that, should do that also in a free market. But if a bank's going to be lending out money, the crucial thing for Rothbard is the people giving the money to the bank in the first place are making loans to the bank. They're not putting it on deposit thinking that money is in their checking account and they can go around using their debit card or writing checks on it. Because then you'd be in this position where the same money is like effectively in two different people's cash balances. And that's where you get into this issue of fractional reserve banking. So again, Rothbard's fine with banks acting as intermediaries in the credit market, but he insists for that to make sense and to not be generating the boom bust cycle and all these other things. When somebody saves and gives money to the bank, it has to be in the form of a loan. That person is relinquishing control of that money in the present and saying, here, I'm lending my money to the bank and I only get it back whenever, in a year. And so maybe the person buys a 12-month CD, which is a certificate of deposit, which actually is a misleading title since we're trying to get you to not think of it as a deposit. But that when you buy a CD, you're lending your money to the bank, and you can't just show up and say, give it back to me, the way you can with a checking account. Okay, so how does loan banking work? So again, what we're going to walk through here now is totally fine as far as Rothbard is concerned. So here, I left all these filled in because I wanted you to have a clean copy, because I was afraid if I just started writing stuff with my handwriting, it would be too messy because it's too small here, and there's all the information I got to put in here. So with the pen, I'll just kind of point you so you can see where I'm looking. Okay, so what we're doing, just make sure, big picture here, we're walking through the balance sheet of a bank that right now is engaged in perfectly fine Rothbardian loan banking. And so I want you to understand how it works step by step and how the balance sheet looks at various points in the process of loan banking. And then once you get that down, once you get this, you know, you'll see how the bankers make money or lose money if the loans turn sour. So you'll understand the rewards and risks of loan banking from the balance sheet perspective, and you'll see that the money supply doesn't change. And then after we go through this, I'll show you what happens with what Rothbard would call deposit banking, where you take in what ostensibly are demand deposits that the people think are going to stay in the vault, and then you go and lend them those things out. And so you'll see the difference. Okay, so So first of all, here's the story. So capitalization, to start your business, you got to get capital from somewhere. And so we're assuming 20 investors each put up 50 ounces of their saved gold. Okay, so this is, we're assuming gold is the money in this economy. It's free markets, commodity money. I'm not talking about fiat stuff. Gold is the money. That's what people in the community use when they go into stores. They buy stuff with yellow hunks of yellow metal. But remember, there's advantages to having banks. It's more convenient, especially for larger purchases, to be able to write a check or use a debit card or something. Okay, so what these 20 investors each put in 50 ounces of their saved gold to start this new bank up from scratch. Okay, so they open up this brand new bank. They each put up 50 ounces of gold, so there's 1,000 in the vault. Okay, so that's where the 1,000 ounces in the vault, so that's an asset of the bank. Inside the vault, they've got 1,000 ounces of yellow metal sitting there. So that's clearly an asset. You say, what's the market price? Oh, it's 1,000 ounces of gold, because gold is the money. And so that's also the total. Now, if you were really going to do this correctly, you would also say, like, if the bank is a building, you would say, what's the market value of the property? And, you know, if they bought security cameras and stuff that they could sell on the secondary market if they had to, you could put those things into it. But obviously for tonight, I'm just going to deal with the assets pertaining to what's in the vault and the loans that they make. Okay. On the liability and shareholder equity side, liabilities, there are no liabilities right now. These guys don't owe anybody any money. There's just 20 investors that came together and said, let's start a loan banking operation, and they each put in 50 ounces of gold into the vault, okay? And then the equity is the 50 ounces of equity for each shareholder. And so it's a total of 1,000 ounces. All right. So now what happens when they start actually banking? So what do? The bank is going to make two different loans now. So the first loan it makes, it lends 400 ounces of physical gold to Jim at 5%, and it also lends another 400 ounces to Sally at 20% for 1 year. So both loans are 12-month loans. All right, so what happened to the assets? Notice now there's only 200 ounces of gold left in the vault, because originally there was 1,000, and then they lent 400 to Jim, and they lent 400 to Sally. They gave them the physical metal. And so now there's only 200 left. But notice down here, wait a minute. I'm saying the total assets are still 1,000 ounces. How's that possible? Well, because they didn't just give it to them as a present. They made a loan. And so Jim signed a note saying, I am borrowing 400 ounces of gold from bank, whatever they call the bank, Acme Bank, and I am going to pay back that principal plus 5% interest 12 months from now. And I'm signing my name, Jim Johnson, whatever his last name is. So that IOU is itself an asset. And Sally does the same thing. She signs an IOU. However, Sally's venture is riskier, right? So whatever she's using the money for, because when you go and apply for a loan from a bank, you got to tell them what you intend to use the money for. And so maybe Sally's got a worse credit score, or maybe it's what she's going to do is riskier. For whatever reason, the bank is more skeptical that Sally's going to be able to pay him back, so they charge a higher interest rate because it's not as safe as a loan. And so that's probably obvious to all of you, but just to talk about that for 2 minutes. So on the one hand, it's kind of weird that, wait a minute, if you think Sally might not be able to pay us back, wouldn't it even make her worse off by charging a higher interest rate? Yeah, but really what's going on is there's competition among the banks, and so they're really confident Jim is going to pay it back. And so if somebody else tried to charge him 10%, thinking, oh, well, he's going to have tons of money because this is a good operation, I'll charge him 10, well, then somebody else would undercut and say, well, I'll make you that loan for 6%. And so the equilibrium market rate for that kind of a risky loan or a loan of that risk is 5%. So that's why that's what they're charging him. And then with Sally, it's because it's a high-risk thing, they know there's a chance or a better chance than will happen with Jim that she's just going to default. And so to compensate for that, they charge a higher interest rate, because across the whole class of loans that are similarly risky, if they charge everyone in that category 20%, that will compensate for the fact that there's going to be a higher default rate. Because otherwise, if they had to charge the same interest rate, they just wouldn't lend to Sally at all or people like her. They would just always charge it 5% and give it to people like Jim. So since in the equilibrium, people like Sally are getting loans at all, it has to be the case that they're paying a higher interest rate, because what has to happen is the Sallys that actually come through and don't default, they have to pay a higher interest rate to compensate for all of the other people in Sally's bucket that default. Okay. One last little quirk, and this is part of what I was saying that I don't think you would see in Rothbard's treatment. Again, Rothbard knows this stuff. It's just he thought it was going to get too long and technical if he dragged it out like this. But here, I'm showing you the balance sheet at the instant the loans are made. And so notice, these IOUs are valued at only 400 ounces. They're not, I haven't accounted for the fact that they have an interest rate attached to them, because the market value of those IOUs at the moment of issuance is just 400 ounces. So Jim went up, the banker handed him 400 ounces of yellow metal, and then Jim signed a contract. At that second, that piece of paper Jim signed is worth 400 ounces. If the bank went out in the market and sold it to somebody else, and now Jim owed that person 400 ounces plus 5% in 1 year's time, the bank would be able to get 400 ounces for that IOU if it sold it to somebody else, assuming, you know, it's transferable. All right, so I can't dwell on that too long, but just make sure you realize that the market value of those IOUs only increases as time starts to pass. But at the moment of issuance, they're both 400 ounces. Now, you might be wondering, well, wait a minute, why shouldn't Sally's be worth more? Because in a year from now, Sally's is going to be worth, what, 480? But Jim's is only going to be worth 420. So why are they both valued the same? Well, because Sally's loan is riskier. So that's the thing, that they both are compensating just perfectly in this example. They have the same market value. So yeah, the interest rate attached to her loan's higher, but there's also a higher risk of default. And so those two things cancel out, so that at the moment of issuance, that IOU is worth 400 ounces in the marketplace. Which, if you think about it, that makes sense, that the bank is giving up, is spending 400 ounces of its gold in the vault to acquire an IOU that has a market value of 400 ounces. I mean, if you think about that, it makes sense. If the bank went out and bought shares of stock and spent 400 ounces of it, and then you said, at that moment, how much are the shares of stock worth that you just bought? Well, by definition, they're what you just paid for them. Okay, so it's a similar kind of thing here. But don't get screwed up by the fact that one of these has a 5% interest rate and the other one has a 20%. Okay, so on the right-hand side now, over here, there's zero liability still. The bank doesn't owe anybody any money. There's two people now in the community that owe money to the bankers of this particular bank. But the bank doesn't owe anybody any money. This was just their own capital that they brought in to start the business and lent it out. So that's one way to think about it, or make sure you realize these people that founded the bank, they didn't lend their money to the bank. They put their money in as part of the capitalization process. Right? So that's how they get to own a chunk of the business, is by putting in money up front. So they didn't lend it to the bank. They founded the bank with that money, and now if the bank is profitable, they get a share of the profits, and if it loses money, well then they lose proportionally too, based on how much they put in the original capitalization. So since there's still a total of 1,000 ounces in the total assets, then that means there's 50 ounces of equity to each shareholder. So the crucial thing is, at the moment of the loan, there's no increase in equity. So right now, the bankers are neither richer nor poorer because of their decision to make these loans. So notice what they did effectively. All they did is transform their assets. The 1 minute ago, they had 1,000 ounces of yellow metal sitting in the vault, and now they decided to take 800 of those ounces and use them to go buy IOUs from people out there in the credit markets, if that's the way you want to think about it. They invested, if you will, in those IOUs, or another way of saying it is they lent the money to those two people. But at the moment of that decision, those transactions, the bankers are neither richer nor poor. All they did was transform their assets from one configuration to another. Okay, now the payback. So I'm assuming in this scenario that both Jim and Sally are successful with their business ventures, and so they can pay off their IOUs to the bank. So 12 months have passed. So Jim pays back his 400 ounces of principal plus an additional 20 ounces of interest. Because remember, he had a 5% interest rate attached to his loan. So he comes in and gives them 420 ounces of yellow metal after 12 months. Says, there you go. I'm free and clear. And they rip up that IOU because he satisfied it. Sally does a similar thing. She comes in with 400 ounces plus 80 because she, remember, had a 20% interest rate. Same thing. She gives them 480 pieces of hunks of metal. You know, maybe they're gold coins or something. And then they rip up the IOU because she satisfied it. So now at this point, you ask, what are the assets in the bank's vault? 1,100 ounces of gold. Because you had the 200 that were in there all along, and then now there was just another 900 that was paid in. Or if you prefer, the original 1,000 now, plus the 20 and the 80 in interest that were paid. So there's 1,100 ounces, but the IOUs are gone because Jim and Sally paid them off. So the total assets are 1,100. So we know over here, this total has to be 1,100 because on a balance sheet, the left and the right-hand side always balance. And so the liabilities are still zero. The bank doesn't owe anybody any money. So what must have changed on the right-hand side? The equity went up. And now instead of each having equity of 50 ounces, our 20 shareholders now have 55 ounces. Because 55 times 20 is 1,100. And if you want to think of it in terms of percentages, each shareholder earned 10% on his invested capital. So the shareholder, if he wants to sit back and say, well, did a good idea, or what do I have to show for the fact that a year ago I threw in my lot with these guys and was one of 19 other shareholders who founded this bank, he can say, well, I put in 50 ounces. We made two loans that we thought were good loans to make. We waited a year. They both paid back. And now I have 55 ounces. So I turned my 50 ounces into 55 ounces in terms of my proportional share of ownership in this enterprise. And so that's 10% return to me. I put in 50, and now I have 55 ounces to show for it. Okay, so that's what happens if they pay back. What happens now, suppose, in this new scenario, so we're still doing the loan banking, the 20 guys formed, they each put in 50, they made the loan to Jim, they made the loan to Sally, 12 months have gone by, but now Jim pays it back as before, okay? But unfortunately, Sally walks into the bank and she says, you know what, I don't have it. My business went bust. I got nothing for you. I owe a bunch of people money. You're like number 8 on my list, and I got nothing. So she completely defaults. Not only does she not pay him the interest, the principal's gone too. She can't even pay anything. Okay, so what happens now to the balance sheet in this new scenario? Okay, so look at the assets. There's only 620 ounces of gold in the vault because there was the 200 that had been there all along, and then Jim came and paid 420 because he didn't default. He came through. So the 200 plus the 420 is where the 620 comes from. But that's it. There's no IOU from Jim anymore because he paid his loan off. And also notice, there's no IOU from Sally. You might say, well, why not? Because she still owes the money. Yeah, she does, but she's broke. She went bankrupt. And I'm making this an extreme case. Usually when somebody goes bankrupt or defaults, it's the money they owe you doesn't go to zero. But here I'm just making an extreme thing to keep the numbers simple, to keep the balance sheet clean. Okay, so again, assume she's just totally destitute and they realize we're never seeing a grain of gold out of her. So even though they still have that IOU that Sally signed and it's legally binding, this is, you know, isn't a slave society. They can't go grab her and make her work in the factory and pay it off. They just the market value of that thing went to zero. So that they had nothing to show for Sally's IOU anymore. And so that's why the total assets are now only 620 ounces. Since that's what it is on the left side, that's what it's got to be on the right. They still have zero liabilities. They don't owe anybody any money. But now the 620 ounces divided among the 20 shareholders means they each only have 31 ounces of equity. So each shareholder now says, oh, man, I started out the bank with by pumping in 50 ounces. We made two loans. One of them worked out. The other one didn't. It was a complete flop. And now I only have 31 ounces to my name in this enterprise. So that's a 38% loss. Because, you know, each person lost 19 ounces and 19 out of 50. Okay. Let's see. What else do I want to say about that? I think that's it. So, and this is obvious, but banking's not foolproof. If you make a loan and the person defaults, you lose money. So, duh. Okay, so that's what the banks have to be careful, and that's why when they're picking their interest rates, they can't pick an interest rate that's too high, because then the applicant will just go somewhere else, right? So if they had tried to charge Jim 20% on his loan, he probably just would have shopped around and got a better rate from somebody else because they could see, oh, no, this guy Jim's pretty good credit risk. He'll probably pay it back. And so somebody else would have been willing to lend for less than 20, and so Jim isn't going to settle for being offered 20. But they also can't charge too low of an interest rate because in the real world, they're not just making two loans. They're making lots of loans. And so, again, the principle is it's okay if any one particular loan defaults, but what they want to make sure is when they made it, they had mentally grouped it with a class of loans of comparable default risk, and that they charged high enough to all of them so that the few that default are compensated by the other ones that come through. And so that's – so if they didn't get that right, if they had a higher default rate than they expected, and so they didn't charge enough interest on the ones that came through, then they're losing money. Okay, now things are going to get a little bit more complicated, but you need to understand this to understand banking and how banks blow up and all that good stuff. Okay, so, and also I want to make it a little bit more complicated to start showing you the liabilities. So we're still in Rothbard land. This is still fine. There's nothing fraudulent going on here. But it's riskier now, what the banks are doing. Okay, so we're rebooting the scenario. So now, instead of raising the original 1,000 ounces in capital, we still got the same 20 shareholders. They only put up 500 ounces total. And then they borrow the rest. Okay? So there's still going to be 1,000 ounces. So, again, we're rebooting the scenario. You've got bankers. They're good Rothbardians. They're not going to do fractional reserve banking. And they said, we want to start a bank that has 1,000 ounces of gold in the vault, but we're not that wealthy. We don't each have 50 ounces of gold apiece so that we can have 1,000 ounces. We've only got 25 ounces apiece of our own money. So each shareholder comes in and kicks in 25 ounces of gold of his own money, and that's 500, and that's sitting in the vault now, this brand new bank that we're opening from scratch. And now I got 500 pieces of yellow metal in the vault, and they said, but that's not enough to start our banking business. We need more. We need more capital. So what do? They go out to the community, and they say, hey, we're starting a bank. Who wants to get in on this? And so they say, we're the owners. We don't want more shareholders. We own the business. But what we will do is we will borrow money from people in the community. And this is a very safe enterprise. So we're going to only pay you 1% interest. So specifically, we will sell these CDs, which are called certificates of deposit. And again, that word deposit there is a little bit awkward since I'm trying to, this is loan banking. But if you buy a CD from a bank, it's not a demand deposit. All right. So the CD is kind of just like an IOU that the bank has issued to people. So what they do, and so I'm looking over here right now. The bank went out in the community and it printed up 500 of these tickets that say an IOU. We, the bank, this is an IOU from the bank. Owe the person who holds this thing 1 ounce plus 1% interest payable in 12 months' time. Okay, so it's not a demand deposit. You can't just show up at the bank and say, give me my money. They're going to say, no. It's payable in 12 months. Or, 11 months if you show up a month later. Or it's payable in 10 months if you show up 2 months later. Okay? So it's got a specific date on it, saying on this date, the holder of this note gets 1 ounce of principal return plus 1% interest. And they sell 500 of these things. So that's where they get the other 500 ounces in this new scenario. And so that's how they originally got 1,000 ounces of yellow metal in the vault. Okay, now I combined two steps here to save us time. Now that they got the 1,000 ounces of gold in the vault, they make the same loan that they did before. They make the 400-ounce loan to Jim at 5% and another 400-ounce loan to Sally at 20%. So of the 1,000 ounces of yellow metal in the vault, 800 of them now they just turned into IOUs. Okay, so after founding the bank by putting in 500 ounces total of their own money, going to the community, borrowing 500 more ounces, so the bank borrowed the 500, then they made two big loans of 400 apiece to Jim and Sally respectively. Now this is what the balance sheet looks like. So you've still got 1,000 ounces on the left and 1,000 ounces on the right. But the main difference in this new scenario compared to the old one at this moment in time, the left-hand side looks the same. The assets are the same. You've got 200 pieces of yellow metal in the vault, and then you've got the two IOUs from Jim and Sally. But what's different in this scenario now is the right-hand side, because before, if you remember, this said 50 ounces of equity each shareholder, but now it only says 25, because of the 1,000 ounces of total assets, effectively half of them, there's creditors in the community that have dibs on them. If that's the way you want to think about it. And so only half of that 1,000 ounces is free and clear, if you will, for the shareholders to say that's ours. That's our equity in the business. So the same thing with the IOUs. Notice at this point in time, these liabilities only have a market value of 500 ounces. Even though there's an interest rate attached, that hasn't kicked in yet, because that's going to be interest that accrues over time. And right now, this is a snapshot right after, we're assuming they very quickly take in the 500 ounces and then lend them right back out all in the same day. Okay, so at this point, the bank is leveraged. And what you will see in a minute, the rewards and risks to leverage, but one popular way of measuring leverage is what's called the debt-to-equity ratio. And so the name suggests that, saying you look at a corporation and you say its outstanding debt, what is its relationship to the shareholder equity. So originally the debt to equity ratio was 0% because they had no debt. Now it's gone up to 100% because their total debt right now is 500 ounces of gold up here, and their total equity is 500 ounces right there. So the debt to equity ratio is 100%. So there were, I'm trying to think. I think like long-term capital management, when they blew up, their debt to equity was something like, or you would say that they were leveraged 32-1 or something like that. So that would mean like 3,200% debt to equity ratio. So here they're levered, I guess you would say 1-1. Okay, so payback. So what happens if now these guys took on leverage? So the word leverage, if you, what does it mean? I mean, we'll see the numbers in a second. But leverage just means like if you use a lever, if you want to lift something, you just use your bare hands. Okay, you're not very strong. If you use a lever and you do it properly, it like amplifies your strength, right? So that's kind of what the term leverage means intuitively in finance, that if you borrow other people's money and something pays off, the return to yourself is bigger because you didn't have as much of your own money at stake because you made the deal using other people's money or partly using other people's money. So you still get the fat return in absolute terms, but now proportionally you didn't put in that much as much money, and so your percentage return is that much bigger. So it leverages the return, but on the other hand, if it blows up, then you take a much bigger hit because of that magnification. So we'll see with the actual numbers, but that's kind of what intuitively the term leverage means. That just think of it, you know, you using a lever amplifies your own strength. So leverage financially amplifies your own capital. Okay, so payback scenario. What if they both pay back? Well, then everything's great. So again, we're assuming now Jim pays back his thing, Sally pays back hers with interest. So now, and then also we're going to assume that the bank pays off all the people who had lent money to the bank, all the people who hold the CDs in the community, right? Because the year went, because all these loans, including the CDs, were for 1 year. So the year has gone by. Thank goodness Jim and Sally come through and pay off their loans with interest. And so now the bank is in a totally comfortable position, and they can turn around and pay off the 500 CDs that they had sold a year ago. So if you check the math, you'll see now we're left in the vault with 595 ounces. Because there originally would have been 1,100 in there, and then they paid back. If they had just paid back the 500, then there'd be 600 left, right? But then they also had to pay the 5 ounces of interest to those people in the community. So that's why there's only 595, not 600. Okay, so 595 ounces, you might say, oh, wait a minute, that's less than they had, you know, in the other scenario, they had 1,100. Yeah, but here they only put up 25 each. Okay, so I couldn't find an example where the numbers all were pretty. So here, each shareholder now has 29.75 ounces of equity, because that's 595 divided by 20. And so if you run the calculations, you'll see the shareholders earned 19% on their money. So in other words, because remember here, they only put up 25 ounces. They went out and borrowed the rest before making the loans to Jim and Sally. And so what happened is, so remember last time when Jim and Sally came through and both paid off their loans, the bankers made 10%. In this scenario, if you just trust my math, they made 19%. So obviously that's better. And let me show you that that's not a coincidence where that's coming from. Remember, they got levered 100%, one-to-one. So they borrowed as much as they were putting in. So that by itself means their return would be double. So instead of earning 10%, they would have earned 20%. But they actually only earned 19 because they had to pay a percentage point on those loans. Right? So in other words, if they had borrowed money from the community for free, and those people just said, oh, yeah, just pay me back the principal, then by levering up one-to-one or having 100% debt-to-equity ratio would double any profit that they would have made if they hadn't levered up. And so then that would have been a 20% return. But actually, they didn't get to borrow the money for free. They had to pay 1 percentage point in interest. And so that's why their return only dropped to 19%. Okay, but you can still see the benefits of leverage, that they doubled their by levering up one-to-one, they doubled their return less the cost of the leverage. of borrowing that money. Okay. All right. So that's the benefits of leverage. Oh, well, then why wouldn't everybody do that? Why don't they just get levered up 50 to 1? Why don't they just put in 1 ounce of their own money and go and borrow the other 49 per person? Well, because if it doesn't work out, then you're in trouble. Okay, so here we're just going through that same default scenario where Jim pays back his loan, but Sally totally defaults, and remember, she says, there's no chance I'm paying you anything. I got nothing. And so the two IOUs are gone. Jim's because he paid it off. Sally's because they just marked it down to zero and said, this thing's worthless now. This IOU is nothing. Now, here's the kicker. They can't say to those people who bought the CDs from them, oh, sorry, one of our loans turned out bad, so we're only going to pay you back 70 cents on the dollar. They can't say that. That wasn't the contract. The contract with the people who bought the CD was the people were going to give them an ounce of gold, and after 12 months, they were going to give them 1.01 ounces of gold back for every one of those CDs, regardless of how profitable the bank had been. So on the upside, when the bank did well, they didn't have to share any of those profits with those creditors. They just paid them what the CD said. But then on the downside, if they lose money, it's the same deal. They don't share the losses with the creditors either. The shareholders take the full brunt of it. And so the bank still has to pay back the total 505 ounces to the lenders in order to get these liabilities back to zero to satisfy those CDs. And so when you run the numbers, you realize now when the smoke clears, Jim and Sally are taken care of and all those outside creditors are taken care of, there's only 115 ounces of yellow metal sitting in the vault. And so that means the shareholders now each only have a claim on 5.75 ounces. So if you run the numbers, that means their loss in this scenario is 77%, whereas if you remember in the original scenario, their loss had been only 38%. And so it's the same pattern here. Leverage, when there was a loss and they got levered up, the loss doubled plus the cost of the financing. So if the financing had been free, this loss of 38% would have been doubled to 76, but it's actually 77 because it's 76% plus that 1 percentage point of interest that they had to pay when they borrowed that money. All right, so you see the flip side of it. So by levering up and getting basically only going in half and then borrowing the other half, if you turn a profit, it gets magnified by 100, it doubles, less the cost of the financing. But on the downside, if you lose money, the loss gets doubled, plus on top of that, you lose the cost of the financing. So you can see the peril, and this is why you got to be careful. So if they were levered up even more, if they got levered up so much that once Sally defaulted and then they had to pay off those creditors, if this number here, this 5.75, had gone negative, which it would have done if they had borrowed even more money and put in less of their own, then their equity would have been negative, and that's what it means to say the bank is insolvent. Because then they would have said, so if you think about it, what does it mean when your equity is negative? It means your liabilities are higher than your assets. So it means they would have owed people money and not had enough assets to satisfy them all. And that's what it means when you're insolvent. Okay. So now I've walked through, but remember, what just happened there, even though that was bad, there was nothing fraudulent about that or nothing inherently fraudulent. Assuming nobody misled anybody, that was totally fine. Rothbard would have no problem with it. He would say, oh, yeah, they lost money. That's just like if you open up a grocery store and people don't like the location and they don't like the food that you put on the shelves, you might lose money. But there's nothing illegitimate about that. It's just, hey, that's tough. Some people aren't good entrepreneurs. And the same thing there. Rothbard would say, well, yeah, they shouldn't have made that loan to Sally in retrospect, but so they were poor entrepreneurs, but what they did was fine as far as property titles and things like that. And they didn't, at no point in that process, I should have emphasized, did the quantity of money change in that community. So the total stock of money measured in terms of gold ounces didn't get affected by anything that we've talked about so far in this lecture. Okay. All that stuff's going to change now. Now we're talking about fractional reserve deposit banking. And so I'm saying there's no longer a heart. Now there's a thing that Rothbard doesn't like. So I'm saying that. Incidentally, in case people are curious, I'm focusing on Rothbard just to make sure we don't get mixed up. So it's not that, oh, because Rothbard thinks it, therefore that's the right position, but I just want to be clear because there are different Austrians who have different takes, and so I'm using Rothbard as the standard bearer of the person who doesn't like fractional reserve banking. So if you are a free banker, that's fine. I'm not going to excommunicate you, but I'm just trying to make sure everyone understands Rothbard's view since he's the main text for this class. Okay. So here now, taking deposit. So the numbers are going to be smaller here just to keep them more intuitive. So we're rebooting. Okay, forget everything that just happened in the last scenarios. We're rebooting now. It's a new bank that we're forming. But this bank is going to be different. Here, the way we get these 100 ounces in the vault, we're not going to put in any of our own money. Where did we get the 100 ounces that go in the vaults and sitting there, the yellow metal? This guy Billy came in, and he opened up a checking account with us. So what actually happened is Billy comes in, he gives us the 100 ounces in physical gold, and then we give him a checkbook, and he's got a 100-ounce balance on it. And we give him a debit card, too, and he can go to an ATM and put it in there and say check balance, and it's 100 ounces. And so he says, oh, so I can just go buy stuff? I'm like, yeah, look at your money's right there in the vault. There it is. We're just holding your money for you. Okay. And he goes around, and so from Billy's point of view, it's just a convenience. He's just transformed the form of his money. He still has it. It's economically equivalent to him to having that 100 ounces in his pocket, and he can go around and spend stuff directly with gold coins, but it's more convenient. No, I'll go deposit it at the bank, and just walk around now with a debit card in my wallet, and I'll just swipe that at the counter if I want to buy stuff instead of having to hand out clunky gold coins. Whereas, remember before, those CD owners, the people who lent the 500 ounces to the bank, they couldn't go into a store and pull out a CD and say, here, I want to buy something, here's a CD. And the guy would say, what is that? That's not money. All right, but Billy is carrying money as far as the community is concerned. Okay, and so because this is 100 ounces there and the 100 ounces is accounted for in this liability, and this is a liability, by the way, this 100 ounces. From the bank's perspective, when someone makes a demand deposit, that's a liability because Billy has the legal ability. He can walk into any branch or go to any ATM and swipe his card and get that money out up to 100 ounces. So the bank, in a sense, owes him that money, or it's a liability that's immediately due. So it's an interesting kind of liability. And the market value of it, obviously, is whatever his balance is at that moment. And so the way we set these numbers up, there's actually zero in equity because there's just 100 ounces on both sides. Now, one tiny little note. In the real world, even fractional reserve banking, they have equity, right? So you don't literally start a bank from scratch and just take in deposits and then start lending them out. Even the fractional reserve bankers have to put in their own equity to get the thing up and running. But I'm just trying to isolate for you the nature of fractional reserve banking. So this is a pure fractional reserve bank based wholly on lending out other people's deposits without having your own equity mixed in. So in reality, it would be more realistic to put in the fractional reserve banker's own equity too, and it would just dilute the numbers. And like I said, that's why I'm saying for simplicity. Okay. So, making a loan. We've got Guido walks in, and he applies for a business loan at 20%. So now what happens? They now there's what I'm doing here, just so you know, I'm gonna go very slowly through this with the in terms of the balance sheet because I want you to see it. So notice at this opening stage, the money is still in the vault. The 100 ounces of yellow metal is still in the vault. And they've got 90 ounces IOU from Guido. So remember, at this point, it's still only valued at 90 ounces because it's the moment that the loan was made. So again, make sure you don't get mixed up. Guido is a businessman. He walks into this bank, this fraction reserve bank. Why Guido was using a fraction reserve bank, we don't know. And he says, hey, I have a good business venture here, but I need to borrow 90 ounces. They say, ah, that looks kind of risky. We'd have to charge you 20%. Are you prepared to pay that? And he says, sure. So he signs an IOU. And just to help you see the nature of fraction reserve banking, what I'm supposing here is they don't actually give him 90 ounces of metal out of the vault. They just give him a checkbook and a debit card. And they say, there you go. You can go around town, and they write in the thing, Guido Holtzman has on deposit in our bank now 90 ounces of gold. So he has a checking account as far as he's concerned, just like Billy does. And the 90 ounces in there, in his mind, are because the bank just lent me that money. That's where it came from. All right, so from the bank's perspective now, what are its assets? It's still got the 100 ounces that Billy put in there before. And now it has another asset. It's got this IOU signed by this reputable businessman, Guido Holtzman, saying, I just borrowed 90 ounces from you, paying you back at 20%. But at this moment, it's only worth 90, just like before with Billy and Sally, it was only, or Jim and Sally, it was only worth the 400 at the moment of the loan. Same thing here. Okay, so that's a total of 190. So we know over here the total's got to be 190 because the balance sheet has to balance. So where's the extra 90 coming into play? Because we know, as far as Billy is concerned, he has no idea what's going on. He's walking around still thinking he's got 100 ounces, right? It's not that if he checks, if he puts his ATM card in the machine and checks his balance that it's going to go down now. Because no, he deposited 100 ounces in his checking account. That's not going to change if he didn't spend it. So that's still 100 ounces. So the bank still owes Billy 100 ounces. But now the other liability is the bank owes Guido 90. And you might say, what do you mean it owes Guido 90? Because it let him open a checking account. That gives him the legal right to write checks or to take that ATM card and put it in and say, I want to withdraw 20. And it shoots out 20 ounces of gold. They're pretty cool ATM machines. All right? So the bank owes Billy and owes Guido 90. Now, of course, with Guido on net, it's still a wash because Guido owes the bank 90. So that's why the bank did this. Okay? But I did it for you this way because I really want you to see, look at what just happened. The bank, just by making this loan, its assets and its liabilities both went up by 90 ounces. Specifically, the 90 ounces that Guido owes the bank is now on the asset side, and the 90 ounces that's in Guido's new checking account is on the liability side. And so in a very real sense, in a very economically meaningful sense, the money stock just went up by 90 ounces of gold in this community just by the bank making that loan to Guido. And that's partly why I'm walking you through this is because this is a critical point. And I didn't even understand this until a couple years ago. So let me give you the big picture to make sure you see why this is significant. Don't think that it's just central banks that can create money out of thin air. That's not right. Commercial banks can if they're allowed to engage in fraction reserve banking. And that's actually a good thing if you believe in the Austrian theory of the business cycle, because now you can explain why there were boom bust cycles before or in between periods when there were central banks. Right? Because if you thought that only central banks had the power to create money, or the government if it's issuing fiat currency, then when somebody said, well, then how come there were business cycles after the second bank of the U.S. was killed by Andrew Jackson, but before the Fed was formed, there were still business cycles, right? Well, yeah. Well, so then you guys are idiots. It's a free market. And so, it's not the free market because commercial banks, if they're allowed to engage in fraction reserve banking, can create money out of thin air, just like this bank did right here. So what do I mean when I say the money stock just went up by 90%? What am I talking about? I'm talking about over here. Look, we've already explained why Billy thinks he's got 100 ounces of gold in his checking account. So from Billy's point of view, whether he's got the 100 ounces in yellow metal sitting in his pockets jingling around, or whether he gives them to the bank and then now walks around town with a checkbook that has 100 ounces in the ledger and a debit card that he can swipe at merchants' places and get up to 100 ounces worth of stuff, Guido is in the same position, except it's 90. Guido has a checkbook and a debit card, too, from the same bank. And as far as the merchants are concerned, Guido's debit card is just as good as Billy's. So if you understand why we would say Billy's 100 ounces in his checking account is part of the stock of money, well, then Guido's has to be too. And that's the sense in which the money stock went up by 90 ounces of gold just by this bank making that loan to Guido. The bank created that money out of thin air. Or that's what people mean when they say fractional reserve banking creates money out of thin air. Some critics don't like that expression, but whether you like it or not, that's what we're talking about, what I just went over in this slide. One little thing here, just in case the metaphysics is blowing your mind, obviously there's still just this 100 ounces over here. The bank isn't creating more physical gold. But what the point is, under fractional reserve banking, in a sense, that same physical gold in the vault is now backing up more than itself out in the community in a form that everybody is treating as equivalent to money. So obviously the bank can't create yellow metal out of thin air, but what the bank can do is create checking account balances within limits. I mean, if the bank expands too much, we already talked about why they'd blow up and go out of business. But so long as the community believes that the checking account balances of this bank are legitimate and they can always be redeemed one for one for yellow metal, then the community treats those things as equivalent to yellow metal. And so if Guido walks into a store with his debit card or he wants to write a personal check and it doesn't bounce, then everyone's happy. All right, so that's one thing too that might be tripping you up. There's a difference between somebody writing a personal check and they don't have enough money in their account versus the bank says they have enough money in their account, but the bank itself doesn't actually have the real commodity money in case they're asked to redeem it. So in case that was tripping you, there's that issue. So assuming when I say that everyone trusts Guido's checks, I mean, it's true. If Guido walks into some place and he tries to buy something that's a billion ounces and he writes a check, they might call the bank and say, wait a minute, does this guy actually have a billion ounces in his checking account? And they're going to say, no, he doesn't. Okay, so they're not going to take that check. But if Guido walks into a store and writes a check for 85 ounces and hands it over and they don't trust him and they call up the bank and say, does he have 85 in his account? And they'll say, yeah, he's got 85. And they say, oh, okay. That's what I mean when I say they trust the checks. So the fact that the bank says he's got it in there is good enough for the merchant. The merchant's not going to then say, wait a minute, if I showed up and gave this to you, could you give me 85 ounces? And the bank's going to say, yeah, we got it. And then they're going to say, but what, suppose every person who's getting a check from your bank today shows up. Could you pay us all off? And then if the bank answered truthfully, the answer would be no. But my point is, as long as the merchants believe that there's going to be no issue of getting denied by presenting those checks because they can verify and see that Guido's not bouncing a check, they're happy. And so if you understood that, then in that scenario where the banks have that trust with the community, if they create money or if they create a loan, in that instant they have created money out of thin air. Okay, now, all right, I got to speed up here because I want to leave time for your questions. Okay, so now the next step. So I broke it up into two steps because I wanted to isolate. It's the granting of the loan that creates the money. That's where the money creation comes in. So now the next step. Guido's not going to go as a businessman and apply for a loan on which he's paying interest and just let it sit there. He's going to use the money. So what I say is, Guido goes out and he writes checks and drains his checking account, buying supplies for his business. So Guido went out, remember he got a business loan for 90? He went around town, he went to the office supply store, he wrote a check for 20 ounces, he went to hire some painters to paint his office, he paid them, he wrote checks and paid them, and drained, so he spent a total of 90 ounces. And just for simplicity, assume that everybody he spent the money on does not bank with this bank. So when those customers all, or those merchants or whatever, workers that Guido hired, they all got checks from Guido in payment. They deposited them with their own banks, and then at the end of the week or whatever, that bank settled up with this bank, and this bank didn't have any offsetting claims, and so all 90 ounces that Guido spent got drained from the vault. And so that's why you see there's only 10 ounces left. Because remember, in this scenario, we started out, it was just Billy came in and deposited 100 ounces in his checking account. That was the only thing that was sitting in the vault. So now 90 of it has gone away. And the bank is still sitting on 90 ounces of a 90-ounce IOU from Guido. So we're assuming that this was like the next day Guido spent all this money. Right, so not much time has passed, so we're still going to value that IOU at 90 ounces because the interest hasn't started to accrue. So you got a total of 100 ounces here. So that means it has to be the case over here that there's 100 ounces. And so how does that balance manifest itself? Well, Billy's still got 100 ounces in his checking account that's a liability of the bank, but now the bank doesn't have a liability to Guido, because Guido's checking account balance is now zero because he spent it all. Okay, so what happened is Guido borrowed 90 from them, spent it all. So ultimately, those checks went around the community and then came back and the claims came, and so now the 90 got drained. So if you wanted to, you could have just said originally that they gave 90 ounces out of the vault to Guido and he signed an IOU and then he went out and spent it. You could have done it that way too, but I thought it isolated better the nature of fractional reserve banking when I did it the way I did it, where they first just give him a checkbook deposit. Okay. Incidentally, I didn't note this in the text down here, but you might be thinking, oh, so now the stock of money in the community just went down by 90, and that's not true, because here the stock went down by 90, but it went up by 90 elsewhere, right? Everyone else in the community now thinks they have 90 ounces more of gold than they did before Guido spent that money. So even though just looking at this balance sheet and these people that are involved, it looks like, oh, we're back to 100, that 90 is still excess in the community. It just got, Guido just spent it and gave it to other people. All right, so the community, the economy, still has 90 ounces more gold now than it did before that loan. Okay, next step. The German businessman does well. A year passes, so he earns business revenues, let's say, of 128 ounces. And he deposits the gold into his account. So don't get confused. Right now, Guido isn't paying off the loan yet. He's making money from his business, and he's putting it, because he has a checking account with his bank, he's using them as his bank. All right, so they happen to have given him the loan, and he opened up this checking account, and it's true, he's got this IOU that's over on the side, and he's running his business, and he's getting revenue from it, and now he's just depositing that in his account. So what happens at this point, the bank's assets, remember, before Guido did that, they had 10 ounces in the vault. Now Guido just dumps in 128 ounces of yellow metal, and so their assets go up to 138 ounces of yellow metal that's sitting in the vault. They still got the 90 ounces from him, the IOU, so their total assets now are 228. And so that's got to be 228 over here. So where did it come? Where did the extra 128? Oh, because it's in Guido's checking account. He deposited that, and now the bank says, okay, you've got 128 in your account, meaning if he wants to, he can show up at a counter and they owe him 128 ounces of yellow metal. Okay, now what happens? So now Guido is going to pay off. Incidentally, this is a very technical little point, but I just realized, strictly speaking, to make these numbers work out, I should have had Guido make all his profit like the day after he started his business, because what really happens, you see this IOU right here from Guido. If 6 months had passed, that thing would have a higher market value because it would be only 6 months away now from paying off, and so it would be worth more than 90. And I didn't show that here because I didn't want to confuse people. All right, so that's one technicality that, strictly speaking, for the story to match the numbers, Guido would have had to have gone out and made the 128 ounces like the day he bought all that stuff for his business. And so anyway, just don't worry about it. That's a subtle little point, but in case you're really into this stuff and you really know what's going on, then that's one little nuance there. Okay, so now what's happening? So remember, Guido's gone out, he paid everybody, he used the 90 ounces to buy stuff for his business did well, he brought in 128 in revenue, he deposited in his business account, and then now a year has passed and it comes time for him to pay his loan off. So remember, he borrowed 90, and then he owed 20% interest, so that works out to 18 ounces that he owed, so he owes 108. So what he does is, so this is kind of interesting, since he is a client of the bank. So what does he do? He goes into the bank, he writes him a check. He says, I owe you guys 108 ounces. So Guido Holtzman pays 108 ounces to the order of Acme Bank. Signed, Guido Holtzman. There you go. So Guido's checking account went from 128 down to 20 because he just paid 108, right? So from his perspective, I just wrote a check for 108, okay? But notice the 138 just stays there because Guido is just writing a check to the bank. I mean, they're not going to, like, go pick up the gold coins and then move them to somewhere else in the vault. They're just, the coins are sitting in the vault. So what happens is when Guido pays them, they deduct 108 from his checking account, and then they take his IOU and rip it up and say, okay, you don't owe us any money, and you just satisfied it. And so now the total shrinks from what it was in the previous slide because the assets and the liabilities both shrunk by 108. So you might say, okay, so at that point, the money has been destroyed. The money stock just went down by 90. But what's interesting is, you say, well, okay, well, how did the bank benefit from that? What was the point of all that? Well, the point is now they have 18 in equity. Okay, because look what's going on. Well, now that the smoke is cleared, and Guido doesn't owe them any more money, they have 138 ounces in the vault from the numbers we've chosen in this story. What are their liabilities? Well, they still owe Billy that 100. We're assuming Billy hasn't spent any money. And Guido has 20 left over. And that 20 is just, that's out of thin air. I mean, sorry, that's a bad expression for this context. I just picked that up, picked that number. You know, I made it up. That's just because I had Guido make enough money in his business so that he had some left over. So I didn't pick the number so that he just breaks even, because in reality, a successful business person is going to have more in his bank account after he pays the loan back. Okay, so I'm just doing that to show you how it would look. Okay, but that 20, don't kill yourself trying to figure out why is it 20. I mean, it has to be 20 from the numbers I picked, but it's just because I picked numbers that made it end up being 20. All right, so the bank owes people 120, and yet it's got 138 in the vault. And so that means that 18 is free and clear. And so that's now the banker's equity. So if you're trying to figure out, so you say, wait a minute, where did they earn the 18? That 18 is not a coincidence. You know what that 18 is? It's the 18 ounces in interest that they earned on the loan from Guido. Okay, so what happened in the grand scheme of things? And obviously, you couldn't have caught everything, and that's why I'm saying you guys need to get this PowerPoint and have it yourself and walk through it. But in the big scheme, what happened is this bank created 90 ounces of gold out of thin air by making that loan to Guido, and it charged him 20% interest on it. So that's 18 ounces of interest. So after the year had passed and Guido paid him back, that 18 ounces of interest was theirs free and clear. That doesn't get destroyed. The 90 gets destroyed when Guido pays the loan back, just like lending it brought it into existence by Guido paying it back. It went back into the netherworld of fractional reserve money. But the 18 is coming from Guido's business, as it were. Like Guido went out and served consumers and had a profitable business, and he took in more revenue than he paid out in expenses. And then out of that profit, or accounting profit, he gave 18 to the bankers. So that money is theirs free and clear. They can spend that if they want. All right, so that's how they make money. And so now you see why fractional reserve banking is fun for the bankers, because they create money out of thin air and then charge people interest on it, and that interest then is theirs free and clear. Okay. So fractional reserve banking under free banking has limits, and that's why I'm saying it's constrained here by the mask on Hannibal. We talked about it last time, I believe. I think we talked about it last time, didn't we? Yeah. That under free banking, so even if banks are legally allowed to do what I just showed you, remember, if any one bank tried to expand too quickly, then those redemption certificates come back, or the other banks call on them, and they get their reserves in the vault drain too quickly. So that's the thing with this. You have to be careful that you have to always have some gold in the vault, because randomly people will show up and demand it. You know, Billy might spend some money. You know, in that whole example there, I was assuming Billy didn't spend any money. But if Billy showed up and said, oh, I want to take my money, but, you know, I want to close my account and give me my 100 ounces, there were points there in the story where they would have been unable to do that, because they had lent out some of it, okay? So in practice, if you've got about many thousands of depositors, you can get away a little bit with doing that, but you can't get too reckless, because somebody might, you know, people might just show up and want their money, or they can write checks, like I say, and over time, if you have a lower reserve ratio than your competing banks, on net, they're going to present claims to you and drain your reserves out over time. And what kills you, if you're a fractional reserve banker, if ever somebody thinks that you owe them money on demand and you can't pay, then you're done. Because the only reason it works, the reason you can create money out of thin air and that turns into real money, is that the community trusts it. And so once that trust is gone, you're out of business. So under fractional reserve banking, there's strict limits. And the banks can only, they have to have similar reserve ratios. And then even if they form a cartel and try to collectively lower their reserve ratios, there's always the ability of somebody to come in and have a higher ratio. Okay, and then now, of course, the problem with fractional reserve banking under a central bank is that those limits, if you just think about everything that the government does with regard to banking, is to break down those natural limits, those limits that the market would have under what could be called free banking. And so, you know, the most obvious is that the central bank's role is described as being lender of last resort. Well, what does that mean? That means if a particular individual bank gets in trouble, then the central bank comes in and, and bails them out. And notice, it's not that it bails them out really in the sense of giving them, just handing them money. To be a lender of last resort, strictly speaking, means if there's banks out there that are solvent but illiquid. So it's not that they made bad loans necessarily, it's that they owe people money and they don't happen to have it in the vault. So in other words, they might have lent it out to Guido, and Guido didn't pay us back yet, and Billy showed up and wants his money. So that bank, its balance sheet might be fine, but if Billy shows up and says, give me my 100 ounces, and there's only 10 in the vault because they gave 90 to Guido and he spent it, they're going to say, we don't have it. And so that's where the central bank comes in. They can go to the central bank and say, we're good for the money. We just don't have it. Our cash flow is bad. So can you lend us 90 and we'll pay you, 5% interest? And then if the central bank does that, now that makes the individual bank more reckless because they realize even if we get caught with our pants down, as long as we don't make stupid loans and our balance sheet looks okay, the central bank will lend us money as the lender of last resort. Okay, so there's that, and then, of course, FDIC, what's deposit insurance, what does that do? It makes Billy less likely to show up and want his money because Billy says, even if the bank makes bad loans, I don't care. My money's safe because the government's guaranteeing it. So that takes away another huge check on reckless bank activities because now the individual depositors have no incentive to pull their deposits out of banks that they think are making reckless loans. And so that's another market check to keep banks conservative that now has been removed by the government. And so it's ironic that this is all taught to us in our history classes as how the government came in and rescued the American public from these crazy wildcat bankers when it's the exact opposite. It's the government coming in, sending up a central bank and other policies that systematically take away the competitive market's safeguards against reckless wildcat banking and inflation. Okay. Let me turn to your questions now. We've got about 5 minutes left, so I didn't leave as much time as I wanted. Where are they? Okay. Brian Binder says, Dr. Murphy, I was reading some articles on the Fed when I came across the term shadow banking. It was used in the context of Fed liabilities that I didn't quite get a grasp of what it was talking about. Is shadow banking something we'll cover? I don't remember off the top of my head if we're going to cover it explicitly. Shadow banking, it has to do with financial institutions doing things that are like conventional banking but that skirt the standard regulations. And so it's the idea, right now I'm not going to be able to get into the specifics of it. We don't have enough time. I'd want to think about it to tell you a better answer. But it's what they're trying to say is it's not enough just to regulate the standard commercial banks and think that you're safe because the investment banks on Wall Street are doing all kinds of stuff that's very much like banking, where they're borrowing short and lending long. So they're taking in loans from people, they're taking in money from people that, let's say, people are putting in money that they can get back in 3 months, and then they're investing in really long-term things that don't get their money back until 5 months. And so the nature of that operation requires them to constantly roll over that short-term debt. And so then if interest rates spike or if there's a credit crunch, then all of a sudden that whole thing collapses, and that's kind of what happened with Lehman and all those other institutions. It's that all of a sudden the credit markets froze up, and because they were engaged in what's called maturity mismatch, they were dead in the water because their business model, they would borrow from people short-term at 1% and then lend long or invest in longer-term projects at 5%, so they'd earn that spread. And that's great as long as you keep rolling over those short-term loans. But if you can't roll them over anymore, and all of a sudden everybody wants their money back, and then you have to call in all these long-term loans. You start selling those things, and it causes their prices to crash. Okay, Eric says, if bankers can create money in a fractional reserve system, is it possible to have a gold standard in fractional reserve system? Let me see. I'm just skimming through how many questions we've got. So at this point, my clock says it's time to stop. So I will go ahead and answer these questions. But if you have to go, you know, feel free. And I'm not going to say something here that if you don't hear it, you're going to fail the exam. So with that in mind, so I'll go a little bit over because there's some good questions here I don't want to skip. I'll try to keep it so that we're out of here by 10 minutes total. Okay, Eric says, if bankers can create money in a fractional reserve system, is it possible to have a gold standard in a fractional reserve system? Yes, absolutely. All the scenarios we did tonight assumed that gold was the underlying commodity money. And back when the U.S. was on a gold standard, there was still a fractional reserve system. All right, so there's four possibilities. You can have a commodity money like gold being the actual money and have 100% reserve banking. You can have a commodity money like gold being the actual money and have fractional reserve banking. Or you can have a fiat currency, so you know, a piece of paper that the government issues, and 100% reserve banking. So that's kind of odd, but it's theoretically possible. Or you could have what we have now, which is a fiat currency and fractional reserve banking. Okay, so let me just talk for a second about the third thing I said, the one that's really weird. You could imagine, I don't think this has ever been the case in history, but you could imagine, theoretically, a government that has somehow gotten its people to be on a fiat currency. So let's say that the Treasury in the United States issues greenbacks. So they're not backed up by anything. It's just green pieces of paper that have pictures of U.S. presidents on them. But that's the money that people use, because maybe in the past, you know, they would throw you in jail if you used gold or something. So somehow they got everyone using these things. And that's the new equilibrium we're in, and these are the commonly accepted medium of exchange. So they're money. They're a bad money, but they're money. But they have strict laws that say the commercial banks have to hold 100% reserves. And so I think probably what's messing you up is, notice there's a difference between the checkbook money and the underlying base money, even if it's a fiat currency. So right now, let me back up. So what that would mean is if you take $1,000 in green pieces of paper and go to Citibank and say, I want to open a checking account, if it's 100% reserve banking, Citibank takes your $1,000 in paper, puts it in a vault, and leaves it there. And now you're walking around town with a debit card that says you have $1,000 on deposit. And they can't lend any of that out, and they can't make loans with that serving as the base of it, so to speak, or the reserves for it. Okay, so that's what it would mean if you had a fiat currency in a 100% reserve system. So you never have that in practice, because if you have a fiat currency, the government's involved, and if the government's involved, you're going to have fractional reserve banking. Is that the whole point? And okay, and then the other thing that is, you could have gold as being the money. So when people go into the store, they don't say dollars or euros. They say this flask of alcohol cost whatever, a tenth of an ounce of gold. But the banking system could be fractional reserves, so that when you take your 100 ounces of gold and put it on deposit in a checking account, the bank gives you a checking account balance that says 100, and then they go and lend 40 of those ounces to somebody else. So gold is still the money, but there's a fractional reserve checking system, or a fractional reserve banking system. So that's possible too. And that's actually the system that the people calling themselves free bankers advocate. The Austrians today, who think fractional reserve banking is fine in and of itself, they just don't want the government propping it up. Those guys typically are against fiat money, but they are for fractional reserve banking, or they're not for it, but they're saying leave it up to the market, and we predict that the market would have fractional reserve banking. Okay. Donald Bailey asks, If a bank deposits $100 million at the Fed and the required reserve ratio is 10 to 1, do they just add, I assume you mean $900 million, to their own account and then lend from there? Let's not get into that right now. We're going to, in subsequent lectures, we'll go over what happens when the Fed starts doing stuff. All right, but it's going to get too confusing right now. So just to be clear, everybody, tonight we're not talking about central banking at all, except at the end when I was saying how it knocks these things down. So all the balance sheet stuff that I did tonight was with a regular commercial bank, just that regular people open up, and it's your local bank that regular people use. So that's and part of why I did that was to show you this notion of financial transactions creating money out of thin air. That's not something that only central banks can do. But so Donald, that's a good question, but we'll go over that in a separate lecture. We'll go over it real slowly because that gets real complicated. Okay, so George Smith asks, do loan banks practice fractional reserve banking? No, not if they're pure loan banks. So the problem is, in reality, banks in our world do both kind of things that I talked about in today's lecture. They both take actual loans from people, like they sell them CDs, and they take deposits that are called checking, you know, demand deposits. So in other words, they let people open savings accounts and checking accounts, and they let people buy CDs from them, and they kind of put it all into one pot and then just make loans out of that. And they treat it differently in an accounting sense because of their different natures, but they don't make the sharp distinction that Rothbard would want them to make. So when you say, do loan banks practice fractional reserve banking, I'm not sure what you mean. In Rothbard's world, a bank that's engaged in loan banking, no, it doesn't engage in fractional reserve banking at all. But in the real world, there are banks that are sort of doing loan banking and they're doing deposit banking at the same time. Jan says, is it true that all banks today are inherently bankrupt, as Rothbard says? Okay, that's a good point. The way I use the term insolvent, no, they're not. Because for me, I make a distinction between insolvency versus illiquidity, or to not have the negatives. There's a difference for me of an institution being solvent versus being liquid. So liquid is a stronger condition. So for me, solvent just means your assets are higher than your liabilities. But then a further condition would be, are you liquid, which means when your liabilities fall due, do you have the spare cash flow to pay them? Okay, so if you don't see the distinction, let's say that there's a bank that, under that criterion, Jan, I would say that no, I would say fractional reserve banking is inherently illiquid. I wouldn't say it's inherently bankrupt, because as long as the fractional reserve bankers didn't make a bunch of stupid loans, their balance sheet might look fine, their assets might be higher than the liabilities, but it's just they're vulnerable to a bank run. So, simple example, somebody goes into a fractional reserve bank and gives them a deposit of $1 million, and then that bank turns around and it goes and buys bonds from some company that are going to pay off a certain amount next year, and then the next day that guy shows up and he wants his money back, and in the meantime, interest rates have gone up, so that the market value of the bonds now that the bank holds, that would be bankrupt, and illiquid. If they went out and they bought a house, put it that way, the bank took the money and it went out and bought some property that had a high market value, and then even went up, and then a month later the guy comes in and the property went way up in value, so the bank's fine. It's not insolvent. It's got assets of this property that went way up, and it just has the amount that it owes this guy, but he says, hey, give me my money back, and they don't have it. And they don't want to, if they had to do a fire sale and sell that thing, they might be in trouble. Like maybe they couldn't get the amount. But the point is, the way you normally would value those things at market prices, you could say, okay, that was, that you know, their assets are more than their liabilities, so they're not bankrupt. It's just they owe this guy money, and they don't have any cash coming in to pay him. Brian says, is rehypothecation part of this? I used to know what that term means. When I reviewed Mises' theory of money and credit, I had to look that up, and now I forget what that means. Does that have to do with, I don't even want to say. So I'm not sure, Brian, because I've forgotten what that term means. Drew says, is it true the FDIC does not have enough money to actually back everybody's bank account? Yes, that's totally true. And Doug French had some good lectures on that. Malcolm says, from the reading in your lecture, is it correct to say that without fractional reserve banking, there would be no inflation and no business cycle? Well, that's open to dispute. So Murray Rothbard would say that. That without fractional reserve banking, there would be no inflation. Well, if we have a commodity money. So, you could imagine having a fiat money with 100% reserve banking. And then in that scenario, if the government just runs the printing press, then that would be inflation too. Okay, last question on field here. Jay says, so is it possible to gain interest on one's deposit in a warehouse bank? I'm thinking no, since those deposits aren't being invested. Right, great point, Jay. So in Rothbard land with deposit banking where the bank is just a warehouse for your money, then no, you can't earn interest. You would have to pay them because, yeah, they're not allowed to lend your money out and make money off of it, so why are they doing the service for you of having ATMs all over the country and armed guards and big vaults and so on and printing up checks just to give you a service of making it convenient to use your own money? You would have to pay them somehow to make that work. Okay, well, we're way over time, so we got to stop. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and I will post the quiz and send out an email. And I'll see you guys later.